Hello and welcome to this special bonus episode of What Page Are You On? That's why you're not hearing this on a Monday like you normally would. Just wanted to introduce this interview with a true darling of the internet. So stay tuned and listen to our chat with this cool new author.
So would you care to introduce yourself?
I would. So I am online, I'm Teddy Bless, but in real life, I'm Beth McColl.
What is your book called?
My book is called House Come Alive Again.
Thank you so much for joining us on this fine evening.
And it is a fine evening. We're in beautiful Islington.
It is gorgeous. The canal's right out there.
Yep, we're at the office of your publisher, your esteemed publisher.
And we're at Unbound, which is a... It's a gorgeous office as well, isn't it? I don't know what most offices are like, but...
It's cool. I like it. So, books. Did you always want to write a book?
I think I did. I think when I was growing up, it was one of those things. I loved writing. I loved English. It was one of those, oh, I'll write a novel one day and it'll be so lovely. And that dropped off in the kind of teenage years. I thought, well, I'm never going to write a book. Life happened. And then it kind of bobbed up to the surface again. But I did always want to write a book. It was always at school. It was, oh, Beth loves writing. She should do this. And in that kind of encouraging way that teachers are. And it was always there, but I just sat on it for most of my teens and early 20s until someone actually said, well, would you like to write a book? And I said, yes, please.
Is that how it kind of came about?
Yeah, so there was, I think it was 2017, a few publishers were getting in touch just because my social media was taking off a little bit and I was doing articles for the first time. And a few publishers got in touch and said, have you ever thought about writing a book? And I hadn't had that firm kind of clear thought of I will write a book, I can write a book. But it got me thinking, I thought, well, maybe I could. So I had a few meetings which didn't go anywhere for one reason or another. But by this time I'd already started writing something. I thought, well, I'll put together a few chapters and see whether I can do this. And then by the time I met with Unbound, I had something tangible for them to look at. So it was really, it worked out very well in terms of the timing. They said, you know, have you thought about writing a book? And if so, what would it be about? And I had, by
this
point...
Something to show for it.
Something for them to look at and say, okay, we could do this. We could kind of work with this.
And what was it like being published with Unbound? Because it's quite an unusual publishing model.
Well, it was interesting, actually, because I'd had all these other meetings and it was... I just felt, oh, not, this isn't quite right. This isn't my book. They aren't going to help me make the book that I want to make. And then I met with Unbound and they just got it. And so none of that kind of, oh, you're going to have to crowdfund. It's going to be a lot more work and there's going to be no kind of upfront costs covered. None of that really seemed to matter because I was just so kind of in love with the way that they talked about my book and their attitude to me. So I found it quite exciting. It just seemed another thing that I would get to do, kind of crowdfund it and work with people. And actually people who were funding it early on, I spoke to them and said, okay, so I'm actually writing this book now. So you funded it. How can I write a book that you will actually want to read? So I thought it was really exciting.
Yeah, that's cool.
It was a good thing. It was an exciting thing.
So that's how, for the avoidance of doubt, people listening at home, like that's how Unbound kind of works, is it's like you kind of pitch what the book will be and then people fund it and then you write it.
Exactly. So people are essentially funding it by pre-ordering a copy. So I think it's sort of £10 for an ebook, £25 for a hard copy, and it's the knowledge that you'll get a first edition, you'll get a hardback, you'll get your name in every single edition of the book. And if the book isn't funded for whatever reason, then you'll get your money back. All it requires is that upfront kind of cost of the book and a bit of patience and trust, because it's, it's been 2 years now, I think, almost 2 years since I had my first meeting with Unbound. And then it was July of 2017, I think, that I launched the kind of...
funding
exactly.
campaign.
And so that's a long, long time for people to be waiting for a book.
So and I suppose it's not that long in terms of publishing, but it's just all ass about face, isn't it? People have already paid for it. They're waiting for the big reveal.
Yeah, whereas if it had been a kind of traditional publisher, I would have been able to say, right, I've got a book out and it's out in 6 months and it's out. And so people can pre-order and it's not a huge wait. So it does, for the reader, I think, it's a different experience, because I've pledged with a man in the past, and you kind of forget about it, and then it's
like a nice surprise.
It's like, oh, yeah, I did this for the part of me in the past, so it's different.
But it's cool. It's interesting, and I feel like what you're saying partially is that allowed you a lot more freedom than. Or, like, Unbound wanted to mess with what you wanted to do less than maybe other publishers
Absolutely.
Wanted to.
Absolutely, because Unbound is, you know, very much, like, you have 100% of creative control, whereas in meetings elsewhere, it seemed to me that they had an idea of what they wanted me to write, and it felt like, you know, you can have the ideas and you'll write it, but we will heavily edit it, and it will. We want this book, about mental health, and we want this kind of twee kind of manual about, you know, anxiety and depression, you know, don't mention this, and we'll put your name on it. Whereas with Unbound, it's, I mean, obviously within reason,
yeah,
I have full control, which is, you know, it's so exciting as a writer. Obviously, it's just the dream.
It is the dream.
It's the dream.
What was kind of your, so you just talked about a little bit about, like, what you didn't want. So what did you want this book to do or not do? What were were there like big things in your mind that you were like, I want to do this, I do not intend for it to do this?
So I think my main thing was, having read a lot of mental health books and self-help books when I was maybe kind of 17, 18, I just didn't want it to be patronising. I didn't want it to gloss over the things that were difficult to talk about, but I also didn't want to kind of make them sound really kind of world-endingly bad. And so I wanted it to be funny and accessible. I wanted to make as light of the worst aspects of mental illness as I can without being kind of thoughtless about it. So that was a big thing for me. I wanted to kind of name the things. I wanted to talk about suicide and self-harm and the kind of uglier and less palatable, you know, aspects of mental illness and whether that's a personality disorder or you know, good old depression. I wanted to just say the kind of truth, or say the just what it actually looks like and what it actually feels like, rather than a kind of dolled up, more pleasant,
sanitized version.
So that was a big thing for me. I didn't want to kind of offer, like, this is going to absolutely save your life, it's going to change everything, rather than, you know, what it is, which is just, here's some information, here's what I've tried and what has helped, here's a kind of beginning and here's a stepping stone, rather than this is it, this is the answer, you'll never need another book again. It was, this might help you and this might help your family, this might help in some way, but it's not going to do all of the work. It's not a shortcut, it's not an instead of doing that hard work of recovery. And I just wanted to be honest, really,
because it felt a lot like, given that this book will not cure your mental illness, here are some practical ways to make your life as you're living it now more kind of bearable and pleasant.
Yeah.
And like practical things, and also like not always practical things, like support things. And yeah, felt very kind of kind and comforting and realistic for
good.
Human life as we live it today.
Because that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to be like, you know, I know when I'm in the worst, in that kind of dead space, you're really not functioning. It's really kind of a gross and nothing is moving and, you know, you are stuck there. I wanted to say, right, if you're stuck there, there's zero judgments, but here's some things, you know, open a window. And if all you need to do is open a window, get a glass of water, you've done enough. Which I wasn't seeing so much. I was seeing people being like, just push through it. And just, sometimes you can't push through, and sometimes you do have to just exist. And to be able to do that, and for someone to say, this isn't a shameful thing, it feels very shameful, and it, you know, it's disgusting and it's hard in these ways, but it's actually not, you know, it's kind of a morally neutral thing. That was new for me, and I kind of appreciated every instance where someone said that to me. And so I thought, well, I'm going to write a book that is based on that non-judgmental approach to mental illness.
So it's a very personal book, and you put a lot of yourself into it, but it's not a memoir. How did you draw that line?
I mean, I think, because even in the early stages, I was thinking, okay, how many anecdotes do I tell, and how much do I make this about what I've been through? And I just thought, I think I was 23, 24 when I was writing this, so I haven't lived a haven't lived a long enough life to have anything, you know, these stories aren't going to be kind of world-changing or particularly enlightening. They're just going to be at the kind of normal for any mentally ill kind of woman in her early 20s. So I thought, actually, it's not going to be that interesting. But what might be interesting, what might be novel and helpful is my kind of take on these elements of recovery that I am, that I have been doing for the last sort of 5+ years. So I included a few stories that just, they seemed like they were appropriate to tell, just so that the reader knows that I am someone who has been through it. And I, you know, there's some things that I thought, oh God, my family's going to read this, and, you know, they're not going to be kind of shocked because they know, but it might be difficult for people who have known me all my life to read them. So I sat with a few stories and I cut a few things out, and I thought, if ever I write a memoir, it'll be in, you know, 10, 20 years when some more stuff has happened. So I think I kind of self-edited a lot just because I thought, no one's going to give a shit about that.
I feel like whenever I talk to authors, I always want to know about, like, write, like, the actual experience of writing the book as well as, like, the finished product. But, like, something I like to think about is, like, what surprised you about writing a book? Was there any part of it that you were like, oh, this is not what I thought it was going to be like, or this was harder to do than I thought, or this was easier, or, like, yeah, just the experience of writing the book. Tell me your thoughts about the writing process.
I mean, I enjoyed it, apart from when it was kind of down to the wire and I had a deadline. You know, that was a bit tense, but I just really enjoyed it. It was my switch-off time, so I'd have deadlines for articles or blog posts or whatever, and I'd get those done. And then for a treat, I would sit there and just tap away, and I acted like no one would ever read it, and that helped me to write it. But I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would. I wrote a lot of nonsense. I think that was, for me, I was like, I cut out so much that at the time I thought, this is genius, this is going to change the world. And then later I went back and thought, bloody hell, it's like tripe, it's terrible. Yeah. So that for me was a big one. You just end up cutting, you have to be brutal. And I was surprised that I was able to do it, because I think I'm quite sentimental with what I hold on to.
Obviously, especially when you're writing like a kind of non-fiction thing that is supposed to be useful, I think it's more important to be like, does this need to be there?
Exactly.
Than with a novel or whatever, where you can let some of your more sentimental stuff.
Exactly, I had to be, and it was right for the book, so I cut out the nonsense. So I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would. And I think that's because it's not fiction. I could dip in at any point. I could start writing one chapter and think, right, I'm going to actually write something that's going to end up right at the end of the book. It's really standalone chapters. So it just made me realise that, one, I could never write a novel, because that's really difficult.
Oh, that's off the table.
I just think, God, that wouldn't be as fun, would it? You really can't take as many liberties. Because of this, if I didn't enjoy writing something, I'd be like, I'll either get back to that or I won't. It all just seemed to fall together in a really satisfying way, which I knew would not happen if I tried to write a story. So I think it really humbled me a lot. My ambitions were tabled a little bit, in a good way.
But you know that, like, you can get the words on the page and you can commit to a long project.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's other stuff in the future.
Actually, ask me again in the... Yeah.
Yeah.
It's written in these, like, short little, almost vignettes, obviously, but non-fiction. Was that a very natural writing style for you, or was that quite a conscious decision just to make it a bit more bite-sized?
I think it was a conscious decision, because I realised that when I was, you know, in a bad, bad way, there was no way. I would see a long paragraph, and I think, absolutely not. And so when I was on Twitter, I was tweeting these kind of bite-sized chunks and saying, like, this is either a tip or a little story, and that's how I was consuming my kind of mental health content. And so when I was writing the book, I was thinking, sometimes longer than, you know, like a page, it just feels kind of pointless. Whereas in the book, you can just see there's the title, it's like, right, what to do on a bad day, and there's a list of 5 things, and you think, it's accessible. So I think it was a conscious decision. Also, I just think I was quite lazy. I was like, right, that's finished, done. That chapter's finished. It's, you know, 17 words long. So it's just a lot more enjoyable to write.
Yeah.
You little snappy boys.
Oh. Excuse me, I was holding that in like the true profesh. Sorry, I've been skipping around a bit, pal.
So, no, it's okay. So as a book, even though it's got these little snappy boys for chapters, mm-hmm. it covers quite a lot of stuff. Like, it's got quite a big scope, deals with a lot of stuff. What kind of reference materials did you use to write it? Because it can't have all just come
from this
fresh
brain.
From this beautiful
God,
brain.
No. So I read a lot of... I kind of Googled, right, this is personality disorders, and I was like, right, I know roughly a little bit, but I, you know, it's just a little fraction of what I need to know. So I read a lot of scientific sounding things. I got a stack of books that were like, had absolutely no, they were all like scientific medical boys, which were just very difficult to get through. Just to give me, even though a lot of that didn't go in, you know, I say like, this is my take on it, this isn't, I'm not a doctor. It felt important that I knew or had read it and had done my due diligence there. A lot of kind of people's blogs on the internet. Like, I really didn't want to read too many books about mental health, just in case I ended up
nicking
yeah. something. It really was my main concern. There was a big pile. I was like, I'll read these afterwards. And I've read them since and was like, that's a bit similar. But, you know, you can't.
Now you have plausible deniability.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I can go off scot-free. So I just read a lot of, yeah, blog posts. I spoke to a lot of people as well, like kind of emailing back and forth with people who were either writers about it or who I knew personally, and just was sending things and was like, is this kind of true for your experience? I was on chat rooms. So I spent a lot of time researching it, but most of it was, yeah, talking to people
yeah.
who had been through it. It just seemed like that was the most valuable thing that
yeah,
I could
like,
do.
What do you need? What do you...
Exactly.
Like,
I was tweeting about it and asking kind of what are you reading and what has helped you the most, so I can kind of go and have a look at it. And so it was mostly just, yeah, internet-based. Yeah. I logged the hell on.
And where on earth did you find a chat room in the year of our Lord?
I know,
2018.
Yeah. I was back in, like, 2007. Especially for, like, medication bits. There's a chapter about medication, which I was like, we've got to make sure this is properly researched. So I was kind of back in the past with people discussing their side effects with medications. On the chat rooms. I think we should bring them back.
No, I feel like that's the conversation that would happen on Twitter.
Well, that's it. We
this
have Twitter
true,
now,
actually, yeah.
But at least with chat rooms, like, it wasn't all set in stone. You mm-hmm. know, like, Twitter never forgets.
Oh, Twitter never,
right?
ever forgets.
Literally never.
Oh, it's the worst place and the best place.
Maybe
you know?
We can move on to that interesting question that you thought of.
Speaking of Twitter, mm-hmm. how do you think social media has affected the kind of landscape of mental health and mental health awareness in the UK?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I think a lot of... I'm trying to remember my experience before Twitter, because I was on Twitter maybe when I was about 18, 19, and that was the first time I'd ever used it to tweet about my mental health. So I think before that, I was a little bit in the dark, and I was a little bit... I felt isolated. You know, I wasn't on... I was using social media in that... really fake kind of like, oh, everything's fun and everything's fine. I wouldn't dream of ever, you know, look kind of going on to Facebook or MySpace and being honest. So Twitter for me was the first place I was actually honest about these things, and immediately found this community of people who were also very honest, and it was suddenly a normal thing to say, like, oh yeah, I've got depression, rather than like a whisper, like, yeah, I've got depression. So for me it was just this kind of really world-changing thing. But I know for because it's as a young person, as a kind of teen, there are these dark corners of the internet where it's this predatory, and it's like you are more at risk if you're a mentally ill young person who kind of logs on and opens up and shares everything. It kind of opens you up for these complete wrong-ins to pounce. So it's a great thing, and it's a worrying thing as well.
A blessing and a curse.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Twitter is the toilet website, but I also think not my life. I wouldn't have all these opportunities. I wouldn't have met, you know, incredible people. I wouldn't be doing this book if I hadn't, you know, there's absolutely no way. This was born from my Twitter account. And I hope that I've done, I'm sure I've, mostly I talk nonsense on Twitter, but I quite enjoy it. But I hopefully at some point someone has read something I've written and thought, oh, okay, that's all right then. That's my only hope with Twitter.
I'm sure that's true. Enough people are listening to you
mm-hmm.
on the internet. So what do you listen? What do you read? Like, what do you think? There's like good fiction that tackles mental illness. What are you reading right now? We just love talking about books, so we're just going to freestyle now about books.
Fantastic! This is the good bit.
Yeah.
What am I reading right now? I've been on a audiobook a lot of the time. My concentration has been absolutely just, I mean, I think my medication, my antidepressants, I'm on 20 milligrams of Lexapro, which has been great for my anxiety and depression, but has absolutely just destroyed my ability to focus and self-motivate. So I just hopped on the Audible train.
Love Audible.
And
love
I am just, ah, I love it. I'm listening to so a Michelle Faber book. I'm listening to Under the Skin just after having listened to
Crimson Petal and the White.
Yes.
Which lasts 40 hours.
Which is such a treat, isn't it? I saw that. I thought, oh, fantastic.
I'm glad that you liked it enough to read another one of his books, which is incredibly different.
Yeah. Oh, so different. I've also read, at one time I was reading three of his books and listening to one. I'm reading Under the Skin and
the most recent one.
The Book of, is it Book of Strange New Things?
Which I haven't read.
It's another chonky boy, but it's really good and it's so different. So I've just been listening to some fiction. After just reading a lot of self-helpy books, I was reading The Happiness Trap, which is a kind of new one that I've never heard of, which has just the ugliest cover.
They often do.
And you think, oh, this is going to off-put so many people. It's disgusting. But really, really great book.
In many ways, you shouldn't judge a book by its cover.
It's very true.
And yet
true.
We do.
Wow,
we do.
I love doing it.
Alacrity.
I can't wait for people to judge my book by its cover. It's so pretty.
I hope people do. It's a great cover. It's gorgeous.
It's great. I can't stop looking at it.
And it doesn't look like a stereotypical self-help book.
No.
I mean, it's not really a stereotypical self-help book, so that's why. But it does have like quite a unique aesthetic to it.
I love
it.
I'm getting sent some books at the moment. I'm trying to remember what they were, which is great. This is the best thing that's ever happened to me. It's the only good thing about kind of being online and being a little bit visible is that
people send you things.
People send you things and it's delightful. So I really want to just kind of take a holiday and just take a stack of books. Because I went into Waterstone and spent about £40 on books I already owned the other day. It was just I bought Priest Daddy by
Patricia Lockwood,
which I've read about four times since I read it the first time this summer. And I keep giving them to people because I think, well, I don't need all these copies, but I better have them.
And it's nice to buy them.
It's lovely to buy. You, like, all treat yourself.
Yeah. Keeping the book economy afloat.
Exactly.
But, yeah, have you read any kind of fiction that you're like, oh, this is a great novel that
just
I feel... Yeah, is, like, good or useful or interesting about mental illness? It's okay if you haven't.
Sure I have, but it's one of those things where someone says, oh, what songs do you like? Or you're like, I've never heard a song in my life. I couldn't tell you. Because, I mean, there's some real clangers as well, which I'm trying to think of. When you just, like...
clangers,
yeah,
too.
Hang on. I mean... It feels like I've never read a book, and actually all I can think of right now is TV shows.
That's fine.
That's
too
fine, yeah. Like, Beth, what TV shows do you like? What movies do you like? And I'm like, well,
any media that you feel has
it's a tough one, isn't it?
Irresponsibly portrayed mental
illness.
I recently watched
what's that film with Bradley Cooper and
Silver Linings Playbook,
which the first time I watched it, I thought, god, that's so stupid. And then I watched it again, I was like, is this a good representative, like, is this good representation of mental illness? Is this different? I kind of find myself second-guessing now, because people ask my opinions on things. I'll get so many messages when a book or a film comes out, and someone says, what do you think of this? Are you horrified? Do you like it? And I'm like, I don't know.
I think that's okay too, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because sometimes you're just not moved by something.
You just
want
to watch and enjoy things without having to... I'm sure you guys get this. Someone's like, what's your opinion? Or what's the tea?
That's why we only give our opinions through the medium of the podcast, having already discussed them and written them down.
Oh, I love that.
Stick by it.
Can you have, like, comments on podcasts? You can't, can you? Because the comments section is where...
We would not allow
it. Oh, yeah. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
We would have no
comment
time
section
for that.
Is our @s on Twitter.
Yeah. But I love talking about audiobooks.
Oh, good.
What have you enjoyed? What would you recommend?
Right, so what have I... I've just read... I've just listened to...
We believe they're the same thing, don't we?
Well, I get into many rows about this online. I just listened to Tiny Beautiful Things by Cheryl Strayed, so Dear Sugar, which I had been reading for years, and just listening to her read it was just the most... Oh, it's just incredible.
A lot of ladies I know are very into her, but I haven't consumed anything.
I mean, it's just wonderful. It's just... She's just so... The writing is just good. You know, when you read something, you're like, I don't need to write anymore. You have got this locked down. You are the best. So I absolutely love her. So I listened to that, and I just would recommend that you just kind of pop it on, and it's hard to listen to. It's just really, it's freeing. I was going through like a difficult breakup, and I was doubting every decision I'd ever made. So I just popped her on, and it's just, it's like self-help, but it's completely not self-help. It's an advice column, but just someone just bears their soul, and she's really, she will just, you know, she's in her 40s, so she's got a life behind her and a life ahead of her, and she's like, this is all the terrible mistakes I've ever made, and this is how I kind of live with them, and this is how I live my life. And oh, it was so healing, and listening to it was, yeah, I think I love audiobooks.
Us too.
Good.
Is there going to be an audiobook of your book?
And guess who's read it?
Oh!
I read it. I know. Hi. I was the voice. Which was so exciting. And I really thought I wouldn't do a good job. And they came to me and said, that ideally with a book like this, we want the author to read it. Can you send us a sample of... And I really put this off. I think they had to chase me up a few times. We're like, hey, just checking in. And I was like, God, all right. So I just recorded something on my phone. And they were like, yeah, cool. You talk a little bit fast, but that's fine. We can slow you down. And then I went into the studio a couple of weeks ago. I think it was over about 3 days. And I just chatted. I just read the book. It was great. I really enjoyed it.
Was there any weird stuff that you discovered about recording an audio book?
I mean, I think I just... You get really used to your own voice. You know, at first you're just like, this is horrible. But then you just flow with it. I don't know whether it's different with different studios, but I mean, my producer was so lovely, and she was... You record, and when you mess up, you just pause and you start the sentence again. So it's really... It flows very easily. Because some sentences you just don't... You cannot get right. And I also realised I wrote a lot of words that I didn't know how to pronounce.
I was going
to
ask this question.
I was like... I think we had, like, minutiae?
Yeah.
And I was like, minutiae?
Minutiae?
So we had to Google a few of them. And I also realised I wished I hadn't written so many medication names.
Yeah.
I was like, Deslavanlafexin. And I was like, why did I do this? So that took a long, long time. But I just think I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would. The sound of my own voice. I don't know how it's going to sound. I also learned that my comic delivery is just dreadful. I hadn't written so many kind of jokes that require good... Because you only read them in your head, it's up to the reader to make them funny, and if they don't laugh, it's their fault, in my opinion. But when I had to read them, I was like, damn it, I'm going to read that one again, because that just was flat. So maybe I'm not tested for a life of live comedy.
But it's not the same thing, is it? Because when you're reading jokes that you've had time to edit and work on, it's completely different to when you're just, you know, like, vibing in the moment.
This is true. So I enjoyed it a lot, actually.
As a natural clown.
Yeah,
as the human embodiment of the clown emoji. You're like the clown emoji and the surf's up emoji.
That is probably the nicest thing anyone has ever said to me.
What emoji are you? You're the little pink flower.
That's so sweet.
Little rabbit.
I just feel like I'm a little boot or something, just a little shoe, just like clomping about. You know, just in the world. Or a little egg or something.
Yeah, a nice little gentle thing.
There I am, egging around. I talk about eggs a lot in the book.
You do.
In one of the edits, like there was a note from the editor being like, not criticism, but you do mention eggs a lot. Do you want to cut out a few of the egg comments?
So people don't think you are weird. Yeah,
exactly.
And I was like, every single one is essential.
I mean, they're all intact, absolutely. Yeah. Also, there was one typo in the book. And I was like, you know, you read it and you're like, oh God,
that's gonna be survive this. That will be haunting you on Twitter.
There's a few like punctuation bits, and I was like, oh my God, someone's gonna tell me this. But I've come to terms.
Yeah, there's nothing you can do about it.
It's
out of your hands.
I'm gonna be mindful about it. Or I will go into the bookshop and just put the full stops in everything.
Yeah. But you know that I feel like people who like enjoy finding those mistakes, A, that's a treat for them, and B, it also kind of reminds me of like people who get a real buzz when they notice in a film that like someone's tear is jumping around. It's like, if you're focused on that, you're not focused on
the
bigger
picture. They can enjoy it.
Yeah, treat yourself. Yeah,
call it an Easter egg for pedants.
Exactly. I've like, it was on purpose. Yeah. Actually, you're the idiot.
It's for you. It's to have fun with.
It's a gift.
Yeah. Well, I feel like I've asked every question I've ever wanted to know.
Have I answered all of the questions? Because I feel like you've said a question. I said, well, I'm just going to say some words now. I might not have answered anything.
No, I think we absolutely smashed it.
I feel very satisfied. Well, where can... I know you said at the beginning of the episode, but at the end of the episode, where can people find you online?
So I am on Twitter quite relentlessly at I'm Teddy Bless.
I'm Teddy. B-O-E-S-S.
That is how it's spelled. I can 99% sure.
And your book is called?
The book is called How to Come Alive Again. You can pre-order it on Amazon or Foyles. I mean, Waterstones.com
or in the shops.
Yes, and I think a lot of Americans, you've got a big American following. I think you can order the ebook from the American Amazon, but if you want a physical copy, you have to ship it. All of this nonsense, but it's out there. You've just got to really want to find it.
And you will find
you
it.
You will. I will never stop talking about it. So
quite right. You wrote a whole book. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. This has been a joy. I might actually start doing podcasts now.
Yeah, this was your first podcast, and I think you have carried it off beautifully.
Thank you so much.
See you next time.
Bye. Bye, friends.